You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Ted Picone. I'm a senior fellow here with the Latin America Initiative at the Brookings Institution. Welcome. We're in for an interesting conversation, I think a very timely one, about the situation of the Cuba's economic reforms and looking at it from a comparative perspective. And we're doing this in the context of a series of workshops that Brookings Institution did with the University of Havana, the Center for the Study of the Cuban Economy and the Center for the Study of the International Economy, over maybe 18 months or more, where we had the opportunity to work with colleagues in Cuba, as well as colleagues from other parts of Latin America and from some of the multilateral development banks, to talk through the evolving situation in Cuba, the adoption of a series of economic reforms by the administration of Raúl Castro, and what lessons can be learned from other experiences in Latin America as well as in other parts of the world. And as a group, we focus specifically on three main themes. One was on economic growth with equity, the importance of preserving Cuba's social protection model, socialist system, along with a job-creating economy. Secondly, the issue of currency unification, which is a major macroeconomic problem for the Cuban system, something that came to be as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union support to Cuba and has now, I think, long outlived its purpose and the great challenges for Cuba in how to change that system. And thirdly, institutional reforms. How can Cuba update and modernize its economic and social institutions in a way that will support the goals of economic growth with equity? So we did a series of papers that are now published in a report, which I hope you got a copy of when you came in, available in English and Spanish. All of this is available on our website. And we also have an executive summary overview that was prepared by Richard Feinberg, and you'll hear from Richard about some of the highlights of that report. So let me just quickly explain how we're going to work through this. Because we have a couple of PowerPoints, we're going to have our panelists sit down here, and they can come to the podium and make their presentations. And we'll start with Richard Feinberg, who is a non-resident senior fellow with us here and also a professor of international political economy at the Graduate School of International Relations at the University of California, San Diego. Richard is probably well known to many of you, has done a series of important research papers for us here at Brookings on a variety of issues around the economic transitions, including the role of the international financial community, the burgeoning role of the middle class and the cuenta propista sector in Cuba, among others. He will start us off, and then we will turn to Marlene Sanchez Gutierrez, who we're very happy to have here from the University of Havana. Marlene is currently an adjunct professor with the Institute of Latin American Studies at Columbia University in New York. She's an expert on international finance, both inside and outside Cuba, and has done a tremendous amount of work around central banking, macroeconomics, and capital flows. And she actually spent several years working for the central bank in Cuba as an advisor there. And she's also currently an advisor to the UN Development Program, Cuba, and has written extensively on this topic. She's with the Center for the Study of the International Economy, which is one of our partners in this process, and we're delighted that she was able to join us. We'll then hear from Jose Juan Ruiz. Jose Juan is chief economist and manager of the research program at the Inter-American Development Bank. Jose Juan brings a tremendous amount of experience from his time in the government of Spain, where he worked in the ministries of economy and finance and commerce. He also spent several years at Banco Santander, so brings his private sector experience in Latin America to the table. Jose Juan was able to participate in a number of our meetings, which we held here in Washington, in Havana, and in Chicago over the last year and a half. And then we'll engage in a conversation and open the floor to Q&A. So with no further ado, Richard.
Thanks very much, Ted. It's always a pleasure to be back here at Brookings. I first arrived here at Brookings on a graduate fellowship exactly 40 years ago, arriving on that fateful day of August 8th. That very evening, Richard Nixon announced his resignation and departure from Washington. It was as though the Capitol was not big enough for the two of us. Our volume on the Cuban economy, the introduction and the overview, that's my job to summarize here now. It is my own responsibility, but it does very much reflect the views of the Cubans and the Latin American economists who contributed to the volume, as elaborated on their six papers, which I hope you have a chance to peruse, as well as the three workshops that we held. The volume is remarkably frank in its assessment of the Cuban economy. It does not pull any punches, and that includes the Cuban contributors. Let me begin with the opening paragraph, which relies very much on the chapters that follow the introduction, and it states, "The Cuban economy has been mired in stagnation for over two decades. Living standards have declined. The economy's historic gains in universal health and education and in social equity are eroding. The outdated productive apparatus is suffering from decapitalization and technological obsolescence, and the nation's balance of payments is under chronic severe strain. Frustrated by the lack of promising opportunities, too many of the best educated Cuban youth are exiting the island." So our volume underscores a very clear lesson from this recent Cuban experience. Without growth, social gains cannot be maintained. To be sustainable, progressive politics requires economic prosperity. On the other hand, the good news is that the reform guidelines, the lineamientos, adopted by the Cuban government and Communist Party in 2011, confirm these lessons and also set forth over 300 steps to elevate Cuba onto a new growth path. Already, progress is evident on many fronts that are described in the volume in detail. For example, the emergence of small-scale businesses is visible throughout Havana and throughout provincial towns throughout the island. There's a recent publication just came out yesterday, America's Quarterly, has some beautiful illustrations of some successful small-scale business in Cuba. I recommend that America's Quarterly volume to you. The many new businesses that are emerging demonstrate the entrepreneurial instincts and the talents of the Cuban people. Also, prices have been lifted on a growing percentage of agricultural products, improving both the variety and the quality of agricultural output for some consumers that can afford them. Government spending is becoming more efficient as unsustainable social subsidies are being cut, however painful. The pension system has been partially reformed. The educational and healthcare systems are being rationalized. Also, most Cubans are now free to travel abroad and return without penalty. Mobile telephones and the internet are becoming more widespread, if slowly by international standards. And also, to improve its international creditworthiness, Cuba has successfully renegotiated some of its outstanding bilateral credits, and Cuba has worked hard to remain current in meeting its hard currency obligations. In addition to those visible reforms and visible progress that one can see on the island, during the last 2 years, the Cuban government has announced a series of structural reforms. If implemented, these reforms would be a major steps forward. For example, deep reform of the system of state enterprises. It began as a pilot project. It is now to be generalized throughout the state system. If implemented, the reforms promise more autonomy for firms, state firms, to retain their earnings to make their own decisions regarding investment, employment, and prices. The government has authorized the formation of non-state cooperatives outside of the agricultural sector, let's say in the urban setting. Cuban cooperatives could be a fascinating experiment in worker-owned small and medium-sized enterprises and benefiting from official encouragement. Also recognizing the need, this clear need for foreign capital and technology, this spring the government announced with considerable fanfare two new foreign investment laws, one for the entire country and the other for the port, the new port at Mariel in the free trade zone there. And just this week, the government announced a list of 246 projects of potential interest to foreign investors. At the same time, the reform lineamientos, they read like a bureaucratic compromise, which is clearly what they are. They accept the importance, on the one hand, of market-oriented reforms, but they reaffirm the hegemony of socialist planning and state-owned enterprises. So as many commentators have noted, the lineamientos lack clarity with regard to Cuba's future development model. The papers by the Cuban economists Juan Triana and Ricardo Torres seeks to overcome those contradictions in the lineamientos. Triana and Torres propose a future development model that clearly prioritizes growth and stresses market reforms and market signals. They would progressively reduce the state enterprise and administrative apparatus in favor of indirect regulation, but with clear rules and incentives. They also favor a smart state in the Triana-Torres model, and the smart state would perform still a great many functions in the economy. So market mechanisms with a smart state. For Triana and Torres, more rapid growth is clearly a sine qua non for sustaining social goals. They would compensate for the excesses in equality, that's their phrase, the hallmark of the old Cuban development model, with elevated standards of private consumption and access to better quality public services. It is the long-suffering Cuban consumer that was the forgotten soul under Cuban socialism. In reviewing the multiple reforms that are underway, author Carmelo Mesa-Lago provides a somewhat more impatient assessment of progress to date. While he lauds the general thrust of reforms, he nevertheless bemoans the slow progress, and he states very baldly, quote, "The greatest obstacle to reform seems to be the central planning model itself." Mesa-Lago asserts, and I quote again, "If Cuba were to follow an adapted socialist market model, as in China and Vietnam, it would achieve much higher sustained economic growth under the party rule. That is, it would be in the political interests of the elites of the Communist Party to move faster and further." Then you might ask, well, why don't they? Why don't they? Mesa-Lago locates stubborn opposition within the government. Orthodox hardline factions, fearful of delegation and a snowball effect, account for the frustrating delays and contradictory steps that have marked the Cuban reform process to date. Mesa-Lago's paper notes that Cuba has seemingly chosen not to learn some of the lessons from previous reform experiences, notably again in China and Vietnam, and also in Latin America, that too slow and partial change fails to generate dynamic growth and the improvements in living standards that everyone seeks. Long ago, Mesa-Lago asserts, China and Vietnam developed their socialist market models where the state's role was reduced to an indicative plan and the decision-making was decentralized. In comparison, Mesa-Lago finds that Cuba lags behind, but could still draw useful lessons. As other countries have experienced, Cuba could reap rapid gains by freeing up agricultural producers, by guaranteeing property rights, and by welcoming diaspora capital. To add to these debates on comparative reform processes, we have an essay in the volume by the prominent Costa Rican economist Alberto Trejos, and he there explains that the dramatically successful restructuring of the Costa Rican economy, and the Costa Rican economy not that long ago was quite a closed, protected market. But Cuba, the Costa Ricans decided to opt unambiguously, without contradictions, and move to an open model based upon international trade and the active promotion of foreign investment. Of particular relevance to Cuba, Costa Rica's dynamic comparative advantage has been its well-educated and healthy workforce. The entire population in Costa Rica, for example, is covered by an efficient national health care system, which is why sometimes American retirees move to Costa Rica to be able to benefit from their health care system and the wide universal coverage that it offers at quality care. So Costa Rica is not an extreme neoliberal model. Rather, the state remains a strong player through state-owned enterprises in many sectors. Workers' rights are sustained through mandatory pensions, generous severance pay, and other social assistance programs. In Costa Rica, attracted by the educated, competitively priced workforce, foreign investment has poured in diversified sectors. We're not just talking about, you know, cheap labor in apparel factories, not at all. We're talking about electronics, medical equipment, life sciences, business process outsourcing, the very same interesting sectors where Cuba could hope to be competitive on international markets. The volume also contains two papers on the very controversial, critical, tough, fascinating issues of monetary reform and exchange rates. Writing in their own capacities, World Bank economists Augusto de la Torre and Alan Ives argue for a big bang, a quick unification of the two currencies and the two exchange rates, quickly. But they do accept a more gradual transition towards adjustment of the exchange rate regime, initially allowing a fixed exchange rate, and then moving gradually towards a more flexible but still managed exchange rate regime with inflation targeting, which is now a common approach throughout Latin America. We also have another paper by two Cuban economists, Pavel Vidal and Omar Evaleni. They propose a somewhat more gradual adjustment approach in the monetary area. They do accept the idea of multiple exchange rates as an interim measure. This is the more gradual path that it seems the Cuban government has already adopted. But let me emphasize that among these four economists, World Bank and Cuban, there is a general agreement among the authors on the ultimate goal of a unified currency and a single exchange rate. The shared objective is more efficient market signals. The idea is to promote smarter investment decisions, better government policies, and a healthier balance of payments. The authors also concur on a critical warning that these monetary tasks are very complex and entail significant risks to the Cuban government and society. A botched monetary reform could catalyze a dangerous inflationary spiral. So Vidal and Evaleni urge the government to be more transparent in defining its monetary policies and strategies and in explaining them to the Cuban public. Now, looking ahead, the author suggests that now is the time for the Cuban government to accelerate the reform process. Among possible policy priorities, our authors in our six papers point to more aggressive reforms in the area of domestic price mechanisms, particularly in the agricultural sector, which could produce quick results, could produce, with more open and transparent market mechanisms, a rapid jump in agricultural production, which, among other things, would alleviate some of the heavy pressures on the balance of payments. The authors also concur that now is the time to open up more space for the expansion of the domestic private sector, notably in professional services, to allow the emerging middle classes to fulfill their talents as architects, as lawyers, as engineers, as consultants, that the expansion of employment opportunities in the private sector would generate more employment, but also hope for the future. for a Cuban economy that is more productive, more competitive, and an economy that would offer more opportunities for creative innovation and for youthful employment. Among the other critical long-term and medium-term goals, the authors point to, yes, moving ahead with reform of the state-owned enterprise sector, productivity-enhancing reforms, admittedly a challenging task. Also, Cuba must genuinely welcome foreign investment. Foreign investment promises not only financing, but also, critically, access to new technologies and markets. Authors suggest that attracting a few large multinationals now would serve as a valuable demonstration on global capital markets. Also, the authors suggest, and we'll hear more about this from our two next speakers, that Cuba should gradually engage with the international financial institutions. In general, then, our authors urge more clarity, coherence, and openness in the Cuban reform process. Clarity with regard to the ultimate development model, coherence with regard to a consistent, comprehensive reform strategy, and more transparency, both to allow for mid-course corrections and also to facilitate future scholarly analysis. Importantly, also, I want to mention, the authors do urge that the government policies actively protect the island's natural resources and Cuba's rich cultural patrimony. But getting to this soft landing, avoiding economic depression, avoiding political violence, that soft landing will require many tough decisions and probably also some good luck. One last word. This volume does not fundamentally focus on U.S. policies, okay? But the authors concur that, ironically, comprehensive U.S. economic sanctions against Cuba are making it more difficult for Cuba to adopt a more market-oriented and a more open economic system. Thank you very much.
Good morning. Thank you very much, Tech, for your invitation. I want to say, first of all, that I am not part of this Brookings project. I have just invited to make some comments in regards to the final report and also in regards to the Cuban access to the international financial institution. In general, I believe that the paper that is being presented today is technically rigorously, and the importance, you know, of the issues selected is undeniable. It is analyzes three of the most essential problems of the Cuban economic transformations today. Of course, there are different approaches to the same topic, but it's possible to find some shared ideas, like, for example, the problems, you know, the lack of clarity in regards to the strategies of the economic model in Cuba, the need to consider the non-state sector as a motor of growth, also the role of the institutions and the importance of carrying out this process from within institutional framework, maybe the comprehensive between in the comparative analysis of the particular particularities of the Cuban economy and also the hardness of the Cuban economy, the irrationality of the embargo. I mean, all of these are issues in commons that I could find during the reading this paper. But I want to focus my comments in just three elements. The first topic has to do with the institutional framework. I really welcome the reinforcement of the rule of the law instead of the use of discretion in the decision-making process, but we cannot expect that it will be, the process of the transformation, implementation of the transformation will be linear and fast. I think that it definitely has to overcome the inertia of verticalism accumulated during decades of centralized planning with predominance of ideology and voluntarism. So definitely verticalism's limits, you know, the necessary interchanges between the different sectors of the economy, and also in some way frustrate the local initiative. My second comment has to do with the relationship between a state and market. In regards to that, I have to say that in my opinion, the clue to success is not in the private sector and the cooperative ones. It is in the efficacy of the transformation of this of the state sector. So, for me, it's very, very important to separate, you know, the supervisory state functions from the economic activities of the enterprise in order to operate more autonomously. But there is a risk in this issue. The fact that the function control is exercised outside of the state company is something fine, something positive, because it simplifies the mechanisms. But there is a risk that giving more importance to the control than to the flexibility and the efficiency of the state company, which is, in my opinion, is something very important, particularly during the monetary reunification process. And my last comment has to do with the monetary, you know, reunification. I favor the gradual approach and the sectoral exchange rate, in spite of I realize that in some moments we will have to, you know, give more speed, or we have to combine, you know, gradualism with some other measures, you know, more fast. But I have many reservations in regards to that. The first is has to do with the response capacity of the state entrepreneurial sector to the new incentive of prices. I have another reservations in regards to the adequate balances between the short-term cost with the long-term benefits, because the realization of the benefits depends on the capacity or the ability of the response of the entrepreneurial sector. And there are some doubts in regards that they can be, you know, flexible to adapt to adjust to the new context. So I think we have to take into consideration that, because as Pavel says in his paper, the costs are immediately, but the benefits appears like a possibility, like opportunity, and will take time to come out. Also, I have some reservations in regards to this issue with the attempt to avoid the impact of the monetary reunification instead of managing it. I think that it's very important that the Cuban authority avoid an unmanageable choice for this sector entrepreneurial, you know, avoid, you know, an hyperinflation or hyperinflation, I don't know how to say that in English, or the social cost of this measure. So that these are my general comments in regards to the paper that we are presenting. And let me now share with you some ideas with this issue of the importance of the Cuban access to the multilateral development bank. I think that to understand this process of Cuba engaged with this institution, we will have to take into consideration three initial premises. And the first is the importance of to separate the International Monetary Fund from the World Bank. I think that technically it's almost impossible because they are twin institutions, but strategically is something important for driving the discussion inside Cuba. Why? Because the World Bank is less demonized than the International Monetary Fund. My second premise has to do with the priority of the sub-regional bank. I mean, and focus the attention in the development bank in the region, like CAF. We are going to see that later. And my third premise has to do with the necessity to take advantage of the cost of opportunity. This is the moment for driving this issue in Cuba. Why? Because the process of transformation is giving the opportunity to rethink the Cuban access to the international capital market, and we have to use this opportunity for try to engage with this institution. So taking into consideration the opportunities and the obstacle that we have right now for driving this issue, I'm thinking, since the academic, that it's possible to think in two different scenarios, the current scenario with a blockade, in which we will have to take into consideration three different dimensions of the problems. The first one has to do with the priority, the second one with the modality of drawing closer, Cuban drawing closer, and the third, the tokens of the dialogue. In terms of the priority, I think that we have to focus our attention in the CAF, because it's, in the CAF, at the very beginning, you know, because it's a very important development bank in the region nowadays, and the United States is not a member of CAF, of course. Also, we have to look at the Development Caribbean Bank, to the new development bank of the BRICS, and in another level of the discussion, we can engage, start to engage with the institutional international institutional financial, like the BID, Inter-American Development Bank, IMF, and the World Bank. The modality of drawing closer can be different. I'm thinking in not only in terms of reinforce the interchange, the academic interchange, but also in terms of expand the informal talking and open new canals for talking, maybe to identify some specific field or sector in which we can start to engage with this institution, and maybe to develop some strategic alliance between different institutions and request, maybe, why not, our an status of observer in some of these development, multilateral development banks, but for the side of the regional issue. The talking, well, I think that the academic now in this scenario will is going to or will have to play an important role in this negotiation, but also we can think in different NGO in Cuba, like the Association of National Economists from Cuba, that can help in this process. The economic and political partner of Cuba can pressure, you know, inside these institutions in terms to achieve a Cuban membership, a Cuban future membership to this institution. And also I'm thinking in the different agencies of the United States nations that are established in Cuba, like the United Nations Development Program, for example, that can play a role, you know, as a platform for the cooperation sur-sur with this institution. And finally, I want to give you some idea of my future scenario. This is a flexibilization, an embargo flexibilization scenario in which I think that we have to establish some priorities too. And maybe it will be interesting to begin to think in the Inter-American Development Bank, because it is a regional bank. It's not much better, you know, the situation of the region. And at the same time, we have to make some engagement, you know, with International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. But we have to take into consideration four main variables, in my opinion, political variables that have to do with the possibility that in the context of lifting the blockade, Cuba might refuse to join to this institution. It will be a political mistake, but, well, we have to keep it in mind, too. I have thinking in another variable, that is the dialogue variable, in which we I consider that the political and economic partner of Cuba inside this institution will have to play the most important role in this moment in order to pressure for the membership, Cuban, a future Cuban membership to this institution, there is another variable of expertise that has to do with, to know, to review the experience of the China and Vietnam in the use of the resources of these institutions, and also the experience of the former Soviet Union in the process of entrance in the International Monetary Fund, also the World Bank. But also I think that we will have to take into consideration the Cuban experience in terms of social progress. Cuba has something to offer to these institutions, to the multilateral Development Bank, also to the International Monetary Fund. There is something to learn from Cuba. I feel that. And finally, the time. This is a variable that we have to take into consideration all the time, because the time is almost over for the implementation of too many reforms. And it will take place to become members of this institution. So we have to start right now. We have to start from now to this process, because maybe this institution are not the best institution, but there aren't another similar, you know. So it's important for Cuba being inside, you know, and not outside. So that these are my comments. I fulfill with the time. So,
okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ted. Thank you, Brookings, for inviting me to be here. I will begin my comments just raising this question. What do you think these three books have in common? You see there the report of Banco Mundial on the Spanish economy in 1962, Weak Laws from Sartre, and Lezama Lima Paradise. Well, these three books have in common one very simple thing. I have both these books in the back store of a bookshop in Madrid in 1969. All three were censored. We were not able to buy this book. And the idea of isolation for me is the idea of not being able to know what is going on outside. This is very important. Very, very important, because when you don't know what is going out outside, and people outside don't really know what is going on inside, we tend to dream. We tend to imagine things. And my first comment will be that I am very grateful to Brookings and the IMF, the World Bank, CEPAL, CAF, IDB, for being able to put together a group of experts to talk with numbers. We talk about reality, to try to show the world that we have a passion to learn, a passion to know what is going on. And I think this is extremely important, because being disconnected, it's really the first step to make very bad decision, very bad diagnosis on the reality. Let me go just to what Richard was saying. I found that the paper, the book that you have on your hands today, it's really a very interesting paper. I think he made a very important step forward. It's also a fair balance of what is going there. You have there inside people, Cubans from inside, experts from outside. I think it's a fair balance of comments, and I think it's a very clear diagnosis. Something important is happening in Cuba. Some progress has been made, but a lot of challenges remain outside. But let me put a very simple example, just a picture of what happened when we don't know each other very well. When you put the Richard report on Ward Lee, what you see is that we are talking about Cuban in international comparison, but when you put the 25 words that are more repeated in the report, what you see is Cuba, 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 Cuba. Cuba, it's too much Cuba. Cuba tends to be put at the center of the analysis. And I think this is a mistake. Cuba is very different in very different situation, political, economically, socially. It's very different, or maybe it's very different, or we think it's very different from what is going on outside the world. But when you compare Cuba with other Latin American countries, when you compare Cuba with other countries in the world, what you get is something similar to that. Maybe you have an idea that Cuba has been an economic disaster or economic success, whatever is your image. But if you compare Cuba as a GDP per capita in Cuba in the 50s relative to the United States, the GDP per capita in our representative Latin American countries as against the United States from the 50s to the 2010, this is the latest data I have. This data come from pain tables. I didn't make just to make the algebra. What you see is the following. Cuba has not been very different from the rest of Latin America. Cuba and Latin America have a very similar situation. They are not more than 25% of the gap between the GDP per capita of Cuba and the rest of Latin America. It's more or less the same. It's around 25% of the GDP per capita, and all of them has been going down. And this suggests to me that maybe, although Cuba has a lot of difference, maybe you have there a problem that is common, that is shared for many countries in Latin America. And what you see, it's something that is very disturbing. Countries that were, the countries which were near United States in the 50s, have been the countries which has been diverging through the next 50 years. Countries that were very far away from GDP per capita in Latin America has been to some extent converging. You see there that Chile, that Puerto Rico above all, that Brazil are now have been narrowing the welfare gap, but countries such as Venezuela, Argentina, Cuba, Uruguay, Jamaica, they have been widening the GDP gap. And maybe you can go to the pain tables and try to see what has happened here. Well, what has happened here is that productivity in Latin America has been very poor as against the United States. Total factor productivity has been very, very poor. You have invested, you have created labor, you have increased your human capital, you have been giving people education, but this has been very useful to narrow the gap. But when you come to total factor productivity, how you have combined these resources, what you get is that we have been lagging behind and the GDP per capita has been lowering. And this situation of total factor productivity in Latin America is not different from what has happened in Cuba. When you go to numbers made by Madrid in the 80s, now made by Jaime Doime Adios in the 90s, what you see is that total factor productivity in Cuba, it's really a disaster. It's going down. It has a negative contribution to GDP. And I think this is a very important thing. It's a very important and interesting question. Why Cuba, being so different from the rest of Latin America, has the same problem at the heart of their model of growth? That's total factor productivity is low. The rule of law, infrastructure, the quality of education, the informality of the labor markets, regulation, intervention in the markets are so pervasive in all these countries that although when you think in Cuba, you think it's an outlier, it's not an outlier. It's in the middle of the pack. And I think this gives some support to what Marlene was saying before. We know that. We have been studying that for decades. We in the international multilateral banks try to find out what this is happening. And maybe this cooperation, this exchange of academic experience, this is something that we have to put before us because it's important. We can help, and we are ready to do that on an academic point of view. Let me now jump from this point to next. One of the things that I I am somewhat disturbed by the analysis is that when we go to Cuba, Cuba is so important for us. It's so near our hearts, our history, that we tend to overrate the reforms that are made. When you talk to Cubans, they say, these reforms are going very, very fast. Now things are really changing. When do you talk to economists outside Cuba, say, oh, oh my God, this is the speed of these changes are so slow that I cannot see any difference. Okay, this comes to the first point I was raising, is that to put Cuba at the end, at the center of the analysis. Cuba is not the only country that is making a transition from this intervention and central plan economy to something that maybe it's going to be a market economy. A lot of countries have been doing that. And these countries are, for instance, all these Eastern European countries that were there, that have been in the last 14, 50 years, has been making changes. And they have a methodology to analyze and to see what changes were needed and how this change was timed and sequenced. And I think that it will be very important for Cuba to try to put these efforts in reforms in this context, because we need to know what is the difference and what is the relative distance from Cuba to what has happened in the past in those countries. There is a very interesting index of transformation made by the EBRD, which is called Transformation Index. And you see the composite in Transformation Index means that more or less these countries in Europe went from being central planet economy, this is 1.1%, one it's totally planet economy, to something very near a market economy, which will be 4. This is the composite index. And what has happened is that how they structured this chain and which were the chains that were faster than the other, you have price liberalization was at the top of the chains. Now they are nearly market economies in terms of price liberalization. They opened their economy, trade and foreign direct investment, as Richard was suggesting. They were a small-scale privatization. That is what is happening today in Cuba. But what is more difficult is to have large-scale privatization, to have competition policies, and to have a thoughtful governance for the institution. We have to take care of markets. And I think this idea of putting these 6 categories in perspective and trying to look where Cuba is, it's a very good exercise to give you an impression of what is going on. These are the traffic lights they make. You can go there to the page. I have given you the sources. But what I would like to say is that if I try to guess where Cuba is today, Cuba is 1.6 in this transformation index. I will not go to the details. Maybe we have a lot of noise here, a lot of mistakes. But what is important, if Cuba is today 1.6, and you put these in perspective and say, okay, Cuba is going to do as the representative country of these European countries have done in the last 15 years. It will take more than 15 years of Cuba to be near the world economy, to be near a market economy. There are a lot of problems there of timing, sequencing, and the resilience of the economy to these changes. And I think this is also a very important way to look. Let me go back to my first slide. Those books, both in the back store of a bookshop in Madrid in 1969. The only thing the Spanish people knew about the Informe del Banco Mundial on the Spanish economy was that the government needs to build houses. This was the only thing that we knew about, and this was just a communique from the World Bank. And reading again this report last night, I found this thing that to me was really very clear and very, very important, maybe very relevant for the discussion we are having today. It says in Spanish, the government is not in condition to stimulate the initiative of the private sector unless he could clarify their purpose, in which takes or which is referred to how he's going to manage this situation, how is going to be their tax system, how is to be the financial system, and how is to going to organize the political representation. And I think that this very, very short sentence in 1962 in a report of the World Bank also applies to something of what we are today talking about. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your patience as we get wired up here. Thank you. Well, we heard three very interesting, comprehensive presentations there, and I really think they came through the sense of change, but also the challenge that Cuba is facing right now, and also helpful in putting it into the comparative perspective angle here. And it's obviously an extraordinary complex situation, but something can be learned from other situations. I think there are some special, really unique dynamics underway that Richard touched on at the end of his presentation, and of course Marlene referred to as well, which is the comprehensive economic sanctions against Cuba from its most important natural market, the United States, and the extent of those sanctions and the amount of time in which they've been in effect. And I think there's an interesting and very lively and important debate going on that's gaining some momentum here in Washington and in the United States about that situation. And maybe in the Q&A we'll come back to that. But I think we do have to recognize that that does put Cuba in a pretty special situation vis-a-vis other countries. What I want to do is just come back to where we really think things are and whether I can get a better sense from you all on whether the reform process, if the glass is half full or half empty. Given what you know about other transitions, given what you know about the Cuban structure, do we think that the reform process is on track enough for it to stay in moving forward? Or are we facing a situation where the lack of progress will really shut things down? And there are obviously tremendous pressures on the regime, and you see it playing out in different ways. The efforts they're making to attract foreign investment is one area where it on surface looks somewhat positive. They've updated their laws and they've established a special development zone at the Mariel Port, trying to attract investments. I think that's an important feature here. But I also see a lot of troubling reports about roadblocks like party bureaucracy getting in the way of reform. So even though from the top there's a direction that says it's time to reform, implementation is very difficult at the mid and lower levels. The issues of corruption, rule of law, and the way the government is handling cases of corruption and the concern that raises for international community is another one. The situation in Venezuela, the declining oil prices, and whether Venezuela will continue to be an important and generous provider of energy subsidies is another interesting moving development. And then finally, and very specific to the role of the international financial community, the currency reform, and whether Cuba can successfully execute this without some type of financial capital support from the IMF or from some other resource. So I want to identify some of those factors that are currently in play and get your sense of how does that affect your judgment about optimism, pessimism going forward.
Well, I want to be optimist, of course, because I am Cuban and I live in Cuba. I want to be optimist with this process. I realize that the duration of the reform cannot be so long because it loses credibility, you know, and it's important to go on and that the people know that the reform is going in the right direction. I feel that we have done a lot in Cuba in terms of the reform, but it is not enough. It is not enough because, for example, during the first semester of this year, the growing of our GDP was just of 0.6%, which is not a good figure, and we expect to grow at the end of this year until 1.4%, and it was the worst economic result that we had during 2008. That was our worst year, you know, in terms of growing. So I consider that really we are doing too many things, but we have to continue working in the institutional frameworks. It's very, very important because it gives a legitimacy to the process. And I think that some important steps have been given, like for example, the new role for the foreign investment, for attract capital and for the foreign investment attraction, but there is not enough in terms that it's important to create all the adequate environment in the country for to achieve that the capital enters. So it's important. And I think that we have an important challenge that has to do with the elimination of the double exchange rate and monetary duality, because it really in Cuba we cannot imagine, you know, the hue of the problem until we don't have a correct measure, you know, for analyze the impact of the reform. So but for me that is so very important. We have postponed this situation during too many time, and we have accumulated too many structural problems during too many time too. But the issue of the reunification, monetary reunification, in my opinion, is very, very important because it can give us an opportunity to review, you know, to measure the impact of the reform. Because now we are working, you know, some like if we were, how do you say, blind. So even more for make all the comparison between different countries, it's complicated for us because the point of departure is completely different. You don't know really. So I think that this point is very important. I think it will be difficult for us to carry out this process of reunification without half a last resort lender.
A lender of
resort.
But anyway, that's why I think it's so important that we start from now to engage with the institutional financial, particularly with the development bank like CAF, because maybe they can help us, you know, with some resources for carrying out this this process. So that's
In terms of measuring speed, I think probably what we have in Cuba is a generation gap with different time dimensions. If you're 80 years old, the changes that have occurred in the last 5 years may seem, wow, in a short period of time compared to my 80 years, look how much we've done. But if you're 25 years old, the last 5 years have been most of your adult life, and the reforms may seem very slow. If you're starting off on your career and you want to really make your mark and move ahead rapidly, you can't wait 10 or 15 years for reforms to you're thinking of an exit strategy. So I think we may see sort of a time dimension difference here relating to the big generation gaps that exist. Fast or slow, how far are they going? As I suggested, on the table are a whole list of very important reforms. And if they were actually to implement those reforms in the next few years, then I think Cuba would move up dramatically in that those measurements that Jose Luis suggested. One thing I think we're lacking in Cuba that you typically find in reform processes is a visible cadre of internationally recognized technocrats who have had some global experience and who the international community can engage with and get a better sense, therefore, of what their intentions are and where things are going. That just isn't present in Cuba. I'm sure there's some smart people in the government, but they're neither visible nor accessible. So that's a problem in sort of judging the pace of things. My very final point would be, whenever I'm asked about, you know, where is history going, I always say, history will be what we make it. And in part, how fast Cuba moves will depend in part upon U.S. policies. Our current policies make it harder for them to move forward. And it would also depend on what extent to which the Cubans make decisions, but also are the international financial institutions prepared to openly engage and assist Cuba in moving forward.
Are they one?
Okay. I would like to be an optimist, but I am an economist. And this puts some restriction on my answer. The first thing, it's, to my knowledge, the reforms, the successful reforms, needs to have behind a social consensus. And I don't know how this social consensus can be created in Cuba, because it's not the kind of consensus that we saw in the 90s in Eastern European countries, when all the countries move and have a very clear target of going to the market economy. This is not the case. We didn't have this clear goal explicitly stated, and we don't know how the society is going to react to something that is very clear. We are not talking about of Parethian reforms. That we are not talking about reforms that are going to do everybody better off. In this reform are going to be people which are going to be worse off and people who are going to be better off. And what you look, when you look at these kind of things, what you see is that political elite is going worse off, maybe in exchange of having a much better off society. And this is very difficult, because if the political elite has the lead in the reforms, I think these are going to be too slow to make a significant change in a very short period of time. And I fully agree what Richard was saying. The other point that as an economist I will also raise is that I have no recollection today of a major transformation what we are talking about Cuba, without having support from the international community. In each of the reforms we have seen, what you see is that there is short-term cost in exchange of long-term gains, both in productivity terms, and that these short-term costs are, to some extent, eased by the support of the international community, either through foreign direct investment, either through borrowing in the capital markets, either through the belonging to having a program with the IMF or the World Bank, as I was explaining to you in the Spanish case. And I don't see these three things, following what Marlene was saying a few minutes ago, I don't see that this is near, at least in my perception today. I don't think foreign direct investment is going to flow to Cuba in significant amounts. Again, Cuba is not the only country in the world. We are having a very, very difficult times for Latin America in terms of external shocks, and Cuba is in Latin America. You were saying something, Ted, that is critical. What happened
to Cuba if all these cross subsidies that comes from Venezuela, Brazil, etc., are now comes to a sudden stop. I think that this is going to put a lot of pressure against on Cuba and the memories of what happened in the 90s with the Russian collapse are going to be back. And you have been saying people that you are making reforms since the 90s, but again, 30 years after or 25 years after, you are again in a situation in which you depend either of being able to create and to generate your own growth domestically in a market of 30 million people. The possibilities of doing that is not very, very large, or resting again in the international community. I think these are situations in which Cuba has the opportunity to do it if he put on the table a credible transformation program who is able not just of just calling for the help of the international community, but above all by the support of their own society.
I think this question of the political elites and the winners and losers is really critical to the pace right now. And the, you know, it's important to remember that Raul Castro has announced that he will be stepping down in 2018. So there already are signs of transitions underway and younger generations coming into power. The question is whether they will proceed under a more open and technocratic kind of approach to managing the economy or follow the traditional lines of more ideological approach. And I think that, to me, is still a riddle. I don't know the answer to that question. But why don't we have a lot of experts in the room, so why don't we open the floor to some questions? Why don't I take two or three before we come back to the panel? Phil?
Thank you. Philip Brenner, American University. I apologize that my first question is the obligatory question to Brookings now that Brookings is in the news about taking foreign money. How much money did this study get from Cuba? No, I'm just...
Not enough.
So you raised, I think, Ted, exactly the right point at the end here that I was going to come to. But let me ask it a little more precisely. So the one of the obstacles to change in Cuba, the political obstacle, comes from people who believe that Cuba's social gains, the egalitarianism, should not be lost. One of the problems in Eastern Europe, for example, is that the market economy has produced inequality. Richard points to Costa Rican health, which is right, except that the influx of outside of foreigners coming in buying houses has raised the cost of housing so much that there are now poor people who don't have housing in Costa Rica. And so those kinds of inequalities are something that some people in Cuba care about. Some people care about simply their current privileges. Can you help us understand if the next generation has the same concerns about inequality that at least some of the more idealistic current members of the leadership have?
The gentleman there? Yeah. Yes.
Hi, my name is Gabriel Ruiz. I am a Cuban-American businessman. I wanted to ask if you can tell us about what is the state of economic data collection, analysis, modeling, forecasting in Cuba, particularly in its application to the currency unification.
Okay, why don't we come back on those two questions then? The inequality question and how that is felt across different, including different generations?
Yes, definitely. All the process of transformation is carrying, as a result of the process of transformation, the inequity, you say inequity, is, you know, emerging in Cuba now. And that is a real problem because this is a challenge for the social policy. The social policy in Cuba definitely have to move on from the logic of the general subsidies how you say?
Subsidies.
Subsidies. Subsidies. I'm very sorry. I'm so sorry, but my English is not so good. Okay. So the social policy has to move from the general, you know, subsidies to the to succeed to person. To identify all of this sector of the population that will be more affected as a result of this situation. In the case of the youth, I mean, there is something very interesting which is happening to Cuba. I was born with the revolution, and of course, when I, during all of my life, we knew the something equal. You know, everybody have the same thing, and the school, everything. But now, the new generation have another mentality, you know, another aspirations. They have another perceptions in regard what they want to do in the future. And I mean, they are a little less compromised, you know, with the engaged. They are a little less engaged than, for example, my generation. Because they have lived all the time in a situation very complicated, you know, for them. But I think that these problems of the inequity is giving some importance, you know, it's a very important thing in Cuba nowadays for the policies. Because the Cuban people, I mean, we have a ciudadana, cultura ciudadana, how do you say that?
Citizen culture.
A citizen culture that we have established, you know, during the whole period of the revolution, in which we have accustomed to some gratuidades.
Free.
Some many things free. And it's create, it creates the appearance in the young people that everything, the state has to guarantee everything. You know, for the Cuban people, for the young Cuban people to have free education is something normal. To have healthcare free is something normal, you know. So sometimes they cannot realize, you know, that this is, all of these things are free, but they have a cost for the government. It have a cost for the state. So in this terms of the inequity, there is something new now, but it's begun during the 90s with the special period in Cuba, in which, for example, the role of remesas or remittances is playing an important playing this issue of, you know, inequity, because the people who have the possibility to have remittance as an income, you know, resources of income can compensate the lackness, you know, the low salary, and it's something that we have to take into consideration.
Yeah, and we should acknowledge that the decision by the Obama administration in 2009 and again in 2011, further steps, in particular on remittances, on allowing more financial support from Cuban-American families to their families on the island, has made a huge impact on...
Not only as a resources of income, but also as a resources of accumulation, because in Cuba, the most prosperous, you know, business are all those who are, you know, supported by remittance, and it is a source of, you know, inequality too in terms of what is going to happen. And there is a sector of the population that, of course, is in a very bad situation, because we are in a process of living in the neighborhood of friction, you know, for buying our foods. And it's true that in Cuba you cannot live with these notebooks. Do you say that? Notebooks of foods. But too many people cannot live without this, you know. So it's something very important to keep in mind. I think that is an important challenge for the Cuban economy nowadays. And this is an empty place that I see in the future strategy, how to accommodate, how to move the social policy in Cuba, which has been historically one of our best, you know, resources, power, you know. But anyway, nobody is going to, as Raúl have said, nobody is going to be desamparado. But how are they going to do that? That's the question. It has a cost for the government. It has a cost, you know, for our budget.
But we shouldn't be under any illusions, Phil, about the current state of equality or poverty in Cuba. There is a lot of poverty in Cuba today. There is also a lot of inequality in Cuba today. The Gini coefficient, roughly measured, is roughly equal to what it is in Costa Rica today in Cuba. So it's not like we're starting from some egalitarian system that the reforms are somehow going to disrupt. Already, there's significant inequality and poverty. Yeah. And the only way to improve social services is through greater growth. And that's what's very much emphasized, I think, in our volume. A big issue going forward will be what will be the attitudes of the emerging middle classes. Will the emerging middle classes care about equity or not? And I think there are reasons for some optimism in the Cuban case, because of most of the middle class themselves come out of more or less of a working class background, and the ideology of equity has been very, very strong in Cuba. So I think you may see a middle class that is more concerned about social equity than you have, for example, in many other Latin American countries. On the issue of the quality of economic analysis, of course, there are many excellent colleagues at the University of Havana who do economic studies. But the government does not publish a lot of data. And that makes it difficult, of course, if you're talking about doing quantitative analysis. I think one of the big issues going forward, as Cuba gradually begins to approach the international financial institutions, is that they will say, we cannot even begin to analyze the Cuban economy unless we are given access to more data than is currently published. And that will make for an interesting dialogue.
Oh, yes, to complement. I think that the problem of data availability in Latin America, and especially in the Caribbean, it's really awful for the economies. The problem is not if the government is publishing the data. The problem is that the government is producing the data. I think this this is the something that maybe is important. For instance, what you have raised is a very important question. You have to change in terms of exchange rate unification. It's something like very similar to a country in which some of the residents are indebted in a foreign currency. And you need to have the balance sheets of all of these and the interrelationship, because you need to know the mismatch that you have there and who are competitive, who are not competitive at the new exchange rates, which are the difference, the feedbacks between among them. We don't know that. Although, as Richard was saying, we have people that come from the Banco Central de Cuba, Pavel and Romero, people in the university. We have some data coming from CEPAL, some SCARCE data coming from there, but you don't have really a clear picture of, from our perspective, maybe this data is there, to make a really fine and solid analysis of what it is.
Take a couple more questions. I see some hands in the back here. Take the microphone.
Roger Betancourt, University of Maryland. I'm glad that you raised the issue of remittances and gave credit to the Obama administration. And you also mentioned the issue of sanctions. And there is something that people don't put together, which is quite relevant to these issues. Remittances are normally sent by recent immigrants. And there was an accord signed between Cuba and the United States in 1994, 1995. Maybe Richard had something to do with it and wants to claim credit, or maybe he doesn't.
Sure, sure.
And sanctions can be applied to goods and services. They can be applied to the flow of persons. And they can be applied to the flow of capital. This immigration accord lifted sanctions to the flow of persons from Cuba to a considerable state. It was signed by the U.S. government. It was signed by the Cuban government. It requires a minimum of 20,000 permanent immigrants from Cuba to the U.S. every year. Over 400,000 people would have made it under this agreement. Those people are the ones that are most likely to be sending remittances due to the connections that remain between recent immigrants and the families that they left behind. This accord survived the Helms-Burton Act. And so if you want to talk about sanctions, why is it that nobody explores the idea that maybe some give and take on the financial capital, which is the real issue, the restrictions on sanctions, are subjected to the same give and take where the U.S. gives up something, some sanctions, in exchange for Cuba giving up something, like obliteration of human rights of some people, and that's for whatever panelist wants to take it up.
Great. And the gentleman right in front of you, yes.
Thank you. I'm Daniel Sandoval from Georgetown University. I'd like to ask you your opinions about the opportunity cost of these remittances we're talking about. Because alternatively, from sending remittances, these Cuban immigrants here in the United States could also, theoretically speaking, return to Cuba. They could be creating industry within the country instead of just sending the actual cash. Do you think there's a possibility for that to occur? And also, how long do we have until the people that would be interested in going back to Cuba either pass away or simply lose their interest? How long do we have until we can actually draw from this human capital source? Thank you.
Thank you. And this gentleman here in the front has a final question.
Hi, I'm Roman Macaya, the ambassador of Costa Rica. And since Costa Rica has been used as a sort of comparative model for this opening of, or potential opening of Cuba, I just wanted to make a few comments. I would agree that Costa Rica, in some regards, provides a model in that Costa Rica had a lot of state-owned enterprises that were opened up. They weren't privatized. It was basically the sector was opened up, so it was competition with state-owned enterprises. But it was a very slow process. In fact, you know, Costa Rica about 20 years ago opened up its banking sector, much more recently opened up its insurance and telecommunications. Energy is only partially opened up. There's only 15% participation of the private sector in electrical generation. And all of this took place over a number of years and under very different conditions that what Cuba has today. We didn't go from a society that was closed politically and economically, and we didn't have a embargo. So, you know, those are two huge elephants in the room that have to be taken out of the analysis. And to say, okay, let's look at just the opening. But we've invested strongly in healthcare and education. I mean, there's some comparables, but I would say you have to be careful in making these leaps of transposing one model to the next, because we've also gone from maybe center left to center right, but very close to the center. Cuba is way out on the left, and if you go by the model of the World Bank, they're going to want you to go much further to the right than where Costa Rica is today. So, I mean, it's a unique situation, and Costa Rica provides some models, but you have to take this all in context in order for this to be useful.
Thank you. That's point taken. It's good, very good point. So we just have time for just a short comment from each of you before as a final wrap-up. So anything on the remittances in particular and then the migration issue?
Well, as it's been pointed out, as a result of the 1994 There was, of course, an immigration crisis also linked to what was going on in Haiti at the time. And so we did successfully negotiate with the Cuban government that the U.S. gives out 20,000 visas each year times 20, as you pointed out. So that's a significant number over time. And a lot of the emerging private sector in Cuba today is receiving those remittances are being used, in fact, as investment capital, right, as equity capital. And that's been, and that continues today, of course. In a number of other studies, not this study, which is focused on the Cuban economy, we, of course, do look at the other elephant in the room, which is the U.S. economic policies. And a number of these studies do recommend that investors in the U.S., and this would presumably be mainly the Cuban-American diaspora, be permitted to invest in the emerging private sector in Cuba, invest directly. Now it has to be done more or less under the table. From the U.S. side, at least, we would say these investments would be in the emerging private sector would be legal from the U.S. perspective, and the Cuban government could decide how it wanted to treat it. So that would be taking advantage of the diaspora and the same sort of people who are sending remittances, but to engage more openly and directly in the emerging private sector. So that's sort of a common recommendation. On the issue of Costa Rica comparability, you know, of course, every country is different. Every country has its specific characteristics. But I do feel strongly that countries can learn from each other and not, of course, take wholesale models and try to implant them, as the Soviet Union did in Cuba, for example. No, you don't want to do that. But can we learn certain things about how to open up an economy, how to run an exchange rate regime, how to system from the Costa Rican experience while maintaining good social services? Yes, I think there are some good lessons to be learned.
Any final comments? Well, I would just add one final point, which is on the migration issue. I mean, there's another way of looking at it, which is putting aside, just from economic terms, I mean, there is the cost of human freedom that has to be addressed. And it's hard to quantify that, but we have to consider that in this equation. But there's another element to here, which is the brain drain that has happened through years and years of Cubans leaving Cuba, coming to the United States and other countries. And we have an incentive program to allow that to happen. And when they get to U.S. soil, they get a facilitated process for immigration purposes. And frankly, our economy has, and our society has been a huge beneficiary of that. I mean, you know, Cubans here in the United States have made huge contributions in many ways. And so there is a dynamic of flow that is a cost and a benefit in both directions that I think we have to factor in. Well, I thank you all for coming, and I ask you to join me in thanking the panel for today's presentation.